Well, epistemologically, idolatry tends to be less relativistic than atheism. Indeed, idolatry accounts for the same for the rather dogmatic certainty that accompanies much unbelief. Consider the amazing certainty that many people have concerning the theory of evolution. At a time when theory has been subject to serious challenges, not only by Christians, but also by some secular scientists and logicians, why are they so certain and so determined to keep out of the school any discussion of its only significant alternative, which is creation, or at least intelligent design? I was listening to a good interview by a sci-fi author, Robert J. Sawyer, very atheistic, and I've thought about critiquing that interview because on one end he says, you know, I don't believe anything that I can't look at my bookshelf and see. So, you know, if you tell me there's a cat up there, I'm more likely to believe. But if you tell me there's a dragon, I need to see it. But then he goes, but if you tell me that I live in a world where we're living in a simulation, well, okay, then I can start to believe that. So an all perfect being who created everything, that's outside the realm of possibility where you have to see it. But, you know, we're living in some type of matrix nothing happened. But he makes a good point of saying that a lot of people, when intelligent design came into the foyer of talking, they wanted to equate it with us crazy young Earth creationists. And so not even intelligent design gets a place at the table, even though you have really good people like Michael Behe and others sitting at the table wanting to talk about it. And so it seems to be more of a for power issue than it is for alternative. And so he made a really good point in that video, which I always appreciate atheists doing. Well, here the answer that is that evolution has become for many a religious presupposition, an idol. You know, it's the explanation for everything. Why do we like scary movies? Well, because your ancestors somehow had a gene that told them to jump at the snake in the grass. And so because your ancestors were able to survive, you had that gene. Now, why don't we have genes that tell us 2 + 2 = 4? Why do I have to go to school for that? Wouldn't it be nice if we could just evolve in a way that we just learn and then pass on our learning to our children? I think that's more beneficial, but I guess that's not what evolution had in mind. Oh, darn. Well, it becomes the idol. To lose that idol would, for many, to lose the fundamental worldview, the framework on which they rely for order and rationality. One of the reasons why Darwin got more popular as he did, and why people like Gould would come out and more atheistic people would put his ideas forward, because they needed to supplant. And it's not just, well, we do away with Christianity and everything's laid bare to us, and now we can have hedonistic lifestyle, or we can live at peace because all the crazy kooks are now rationalistic like us. It's an idea that needs to be, well, we need to give the people something, or they won't continue to work, or they won't value life. So we need another opiate of the masses to convince people to do good. And again, you just need a God to tell you not to murder. Well, it seems to be, if we don't have a God, then a lot of other bad things seem to be happening. So I think the proof is in the pudding there.
Yeah. And so what he does next is, real briefly, he gives us 3 or 4 reasons on why he rejects the theory of evolution, right? Or at least the theory that this idea of macroevolution. He says, for instance, in Genesis 2:7, it's a special act of God in breathing that makes Adam a living creature. God did not take an already existing living creature and make him specifically human, as in theistic evolution. Rather, he took dust and gave it life. So, you know, Adam hadn't evolved to a certain extent and then all of a sudden became a person. No. God breathed into him and he became a living creature, person. And so that's his first take, right? Genesis 2:7.
And he goes on and says that in places like Genesis 1 and following, that the frequent repetition of according to their kinds indicates that there are divinely imposed limitations on what can result from reproductions. A cat can only produce a cat. It doesn't suddenly produce a lizard, no matter how many times it has eggs. that might be opposite, but still, he says that he does not know broadly these kinds should be constructed or how they relate to modern biological classifications as such as family, genus, and species. But whatever a kind is, these passages evidently imply that plants and animals of one kind do not produce plants or animals of another. But that is what must happen in the theory of evolution to be true. We started out as banana plants, and then we grew into ficuses, and because it has more chromosomes than we do. But again, when we have more chromosomes than we do, bad things tend to happen there as well. So it seems like these chromosomes need to change us, but not too much.
He goes on to say that although he's not well equipped to judge scientific evidence, that he'll simply add that as a layman, he's not convinced by the evidence presented to him for evolution. He says, doubtless there has been what is sometimes called microevolution, right? Variations in the distribution of genetic characteristics within a species due to natural selection, right? Like colored moths and that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And he uses this, right? He says in some environments, moths of a certain color become more predominant, and in other environments, those of a different color, you know, this color proves in different ways to be an aid to survival and reproduction. So that's kind of a micro change in terms of moth. But he says this amounts to variation within already existing genetic possibilities rather than a process that produces a whole new species, right? And which requires a whole new set of genetic possibilities. And he doesn't see the evidence for that happen.
Right. Right. We say that Jesus is coming back, and they go, well, where is he? Well, we just need time. And then we go, I want to see a bird turn into a dog. Like, well, you can't do that right now. All you need is just a little bit of time. So there we go. We're all waiting. He goes on to say, further, I agree with Philip Johnson that the real persuasive power of the theory of evolution is not the evidence adduced in the favor, but rather the fact that it is only viable alternative to theism. Indeed, evolution is necessary once one rejects creation, for either the earth was produced supernaturally, created, or it was produced naturally, that is, apart from God. Any naturalistic origin of the world would involve evolution, or it would be the result of natural laws operating on primitive matter, producing complexity over time. Thus, the concept of evolution did not begin with Darwin. Rather, it began. It has been the characteristic of every non-Christian philosophy since that of Thales in the 6th century BC.
So it's always been around. If you have any naturalistic philosophy, it says you're going to have some type of evolutionary process. Because you have to get from, you know, non, for instance, mental to mental. You have to move that. So if you're going to do that, you have to have some type of evolutionary process. And so it's always been around.